This is tape 3, side 2 of The Impersonal Actor. The Looking. One thing the greats really know about is how it goes with the eyes. It is true when the work goes truthfully, more often than not the eyes will follow the natural course of their looking, appropriate to what's going on in the scene and to what's going on in the mind of the character. But is it something that should be left up to luck? Especially when by getting the looking right we can put ourselves effortlessly and accurately right in the middle of a scene? Be watching for what the eyes do when one is hearing something expected as opposed to unexpected. Generally speaking, if you are saying the line, the eyes are communicating the implications of the thing being said, and if you are hearing the line, looking into the implications of the thing just said. Either that, or they are looking into an immediate future. It's no accident that our eyes have been called windows to the soul, but they're windows to the soul not because they express our feelings, but because through them one can see where our attention is, where our focus is, and where our desire is. In the whole of our eyes are registered the implications of things rather than our feelings about things. Then, because we're all human and share a collective consciousness, we immediately interpret these reflections of meaning, our eyes, and then perceive what a person must be feeling, would have to be feeling, to be looking in that way. That's why it always looks a bit overdone when the actor is attempting to express feeling through his eyes. It will always appear overdone because in life, that is exactly not what we're doing. In life, our eyes see meaning. They are reflective of feeling to us because it is feelings we perceive when we look at them, but it is not feeling which is given by them. When the eyes squint, widen, glaze, narrow, or even cross, it's because they see into something. The exception is if you are intentionally making a show of squinting, widening, etc., as a demonstration of suspicion, say, or of surprise. The application of this philosophy is this. If you are playing the captain of a seafaring vessel, and there's a beautiful red sky at dawn, the passengers will see a gorgeous sunrise, but you will see a storm. The greats know that at this moment it is their job to see the meaning of a red sky at dawn, not to try to express concern and apprehension through the eyes. Concern and apprehension are what the captain of a ship experiences when he sees a storm. The difference will seem subtle if not indistinguishable at first, but with practice you'll see the difference to be profound. Again, in this way the audience is allowed to be an active participant of the event of drama. First, because it's human behavior rather than emotional portrayal, and we always know the difference, so we are subconsciously involved. And secondly, because we now experience what we know the character is feeling rather than having it read or indicated to us, even subtly. We have been allowed to ascertain character, plot, and emotion rather than having had it spoon-fed us. You will look for special looking in the role when a character is experiencing a looming future. Let's look at a couple of examples and you know just how it goes because you've seen it a million times. Often thought of as thinking or seeing, it is neither, but rather a staring into of events, present or past, real or imagined, as in daydreams, or likely events and into their implications. Nor is it reliving. What happens is a unique human thing which we will call the looking into. Here are a few examples of looking into. The implications of the immediate future can be seen in the eyes of the condemned the night before the execution, the eyes of the soldier as the enemy infantry advances upon his position, the eyes of the husband in the maternity waiting room. The implications of the distant future can be seen in the eyes of an injured ball player on the bench, the eyes of a young girl sitting on a swing, the eyes of a man who knows he's about to be found guilty. The implications of the immediate past can be seen in the eyes of the football hero as he lays in bed the night of the big win, the eyes of the surgeon who just lost an 8-year-old girl, the eyes of a soldier the morning after a great battle. The implications of the distant past can be seen in the eyes of the old, the eyes of those who left others behind, the eyes that knew the good old days. Say if you are looking at someone now in athletic competition who has met the challenge of an enormous physical disability, you will be looking not at where he is now, but at what he has overcome to get to this point. Say if you are looking at a heavyweight title match and watching a longtime champion take a beating in the second round, you will be looking not at a fighter losing a fight, you will be looking at a career coming to an end. What you are doing is always drawing the thing itself into its greatest possible extended implications, and this is what you will be looking into. You see, the listening and the looking are interconnected in a beautiful, wonderful way. When we listen, it isn't enough to tell yourself as the actor hearing the material for the umpteenth time, okay, I'm really going to listen this time. Because in reality, we don't just look and listen in life. We also automatically process what we see and hear. And in that human process, what we automatically process is the meaning. So then what we see is meaning. And what we hear is meaning. And in acting, we have to do what we naturally do in life, and that is to look into the likely ramifications of what we see and hear. What really triggers your character's response is not the words of another character, but the meaning of what the other character has said or done. Responding to that will always carry more force and truth than merely responding to a fact. Also, this is the way to keep what we've seen and heard for the 30th time fresh and new. It isn't luck. Responding to a fact is limited. Responding to the implications of a fact are ongoing and all-inclusive. Of course, not all of the implications are going to be dark. Many are going to be full of humor and irony, as when you hear that friends of yours are pregnant, one is not merely joyous about the event, but also looking into the long, adventurous road ahead of them. And when you hear that a friend of yours has won the lottery, one is not merely happy for him, but looking into the implications of what it means to his whole life, and also what it would mean if it would happen to you. One more thing. If you are playing someone who is childish or very shallow or developmentally challenged or just really stupid, you may be playing someone who looks into no implications at all or who looks into only very immediate implications. Once again, we're talking about this thing called the looking and the ingredients which constitute it. Why go on thinking that all of this is something which is just going to happen naturally when you can mine the gold therein and actively include it in your work? It can get you into a scene like nothing else. You've heard it said, you can see them thinking. But that isn't really what's occurring. That's someone reviewing what's going on in his own mind. What's really happening when you can quote-unquote see a character thinking is two things. You know the subject of his thoughts because you've seen his side of the story from the beginning, and then you see him looking into the implications of what's going on in the world around him. Those two things taken together equal the character's thinking in your own mind. If you act thinking, figuring out, getting it, adding things up, you're going to look slow. Even at a moment of revelation, you aren't, in life or on stage, really getting it at that moment at all. For the moment of revelation is an invisible moment. What happens in life and is to be acted is the split second immediately after the revelation. The experience is the surprise of the revelation, or the shock of the revelation and its implications, or the obviousness of the revelation. This last is the most common, for more often than not, most revelations are unexpected exposures to the obvious. It isn't a matter of your feelings. Looking into the implications is a matter of mind witnessing universal probability and potential. And in acting, that is something which one looks into outside of oneself. While all truths come from within, they usually manifest as reflections in things outside of us so that we can indeed see them and appreciate them. In review, 1. Be thinking that your character is not so much looking at things, but looking into them. When we say something, we're saying what it means, and when we are hearing something, we are hearing what it means. So it goes when we are looking at something, we are seeing what it means. All acting is about what facts imply, the ramifications, not about the facts themselves. 2. Most looking that is not into the eyes of another character is into the immediate future, the immediate past, the distant future, or the distant past. Objectivity. Playwright William Inge said, "Originality is undetected plagiarism." There's nothing new under the sun. How many times have you heard that expression? What does it mean? Well, there is, in essence, no feeling that has not been felt before, no human experience that has not been experienced before, no thought that has not been thought, no communication that has not been communicated. Can you think of anything that you have ever thought, that you have ever felt, that you think has never, in essence, been thought or felt before? Of course not. That's because everything that you have ever experienced is part of a universe over the ages through a universal consciousness. So you see, in reality, we have no personal thought. There is, in fact, nothing personal about us. We all have the same organs, more or less, the same activity, the same human experience, would we not? After all, we are one humanity. So why would any one person's feelings or thoughts be more important than another's, since they are not only shared, but in fact come from the same place? To be aware of this to the extent that it is included in the way we relate to the rest of the world is what's known as objectivity. Objectivity is a quality in life which the vast majority of us possess, and which, of course, as you might guess, the most highly skilled actors include in their work. It is the quality of being able to at least try to see yourself as others see you. One definition of objectivity is uninfluenced by personal prejudice. It's a wonderful thing when we realize that this gift is the very method by which we give one another credit for being around. We're usually better at this thing called objectivity when in groups of people, where there are more witnesses to our possible exposure of ego than we are in one-to-one exchanges with those familiar to us, for example, in an emotional family situation. But most of us retain an enormous amount of objectivity even when around those who know us best. So, as a result of the evolution of communication over the thousands and thousands of years, communication, after all, being the way we've learned to try to become one, we've included a way of speaking about ourselves in front of others which has removed any sense that our own life experiences are essentially different from the life experiences of others. So we have in our communications to one another removed from our public self-speech any quality portraying our lives as being highly personal. In reality, our existence here on Earth is structured upon an already existing gene pool, hardly a personal thing at all. Think about it. Now, many actors choose to portray their characters as victims. In life, do you strive to portray yourself as a victim? Yes, there are people who do this with remarkable frequency, but they do not have many friends, and frankly, stories about them are rarely told. And that's because there's no redemption in one who remains the victim. And most drama is about redemption, or at least about a darn good try. While not long tolerated in life, subtly playing the victim is initially rewarded by certain artistic authority figures because to the naked eye it appears to be raw and vulnerable, emotional, complex, and most of all deep. It seems to be angry, out of control, and has an edge to it. The idea, of course, is to find the life, the heartbeat, the activity, the fire, which exists every day in life without resorting to one-dimensional negativity and arbitrary conflict. Writing is about mankind striving, not whining. Objectivity is the quality in life and in acting that allows us to see that everyone has their ups and downs, especially our own characters. It causes our characters to not take themselves quite so seriously. Is it logical to think that a writer has spent so much time and effort to construct a character whose first response to adversity is accusation, feeling sorry for himself, and anger? Doesn't life tell us to look instead in the writing for someone more like yourself? Someone who, when faced with a problem, tries his best to cope? We want to cope. We want to be winning. We don't want to burden our friends and neighbors with our trials and miseries because we just know that everyone has troubles of his own, and because most of us, most of the time, under extreme stress, do the best we can. We strive. Then why would the actor choose to play what he himself would rarely, if ever, do, complain, blame others, act hurt? To do these things as your starting point is to establish them as the norm, so that when your character actually is struggling, it would then have no meaning. Only rarely are parts written where your character is primarily of this kind of negative nature, and in this case, the story will always be about this person's rise out of that condition to a livable one. Unless, of course, it's a comedic short about people we don't want to meet. Now, in comedy, there is an exception. Lately, we have seen characters who are leads in comedic episodics who are apparently awfully negative people. If you look carefully, and if the show continues to succeed, you'll see that their negativity, if at all watchable and funny, is intended by the character as a form of entertainment of a perverse nature. Let me repeat that. The griping, the complaining, the whining, etc. If it is at all funny, is so because it is intended by the character as a kind of perverse entertainment, not as a true reflection of their general state. Is the character you are playing less than you? Does he or she deserve less? Does a character strive less than you? Of course not. Writers know this. They know that an audience watching a character in the midst of difficulty, while knowing that the character is in fact dying underneath, that audience will be moved by the strength and nobility of that character under stress, moved because we humans feel and have always felt a great admiration for courage in adversity. It's part of our human collective consciousness to feel this way. Writers, good writers, know this and employ this because it moves people, normal people. We are not moved by people who cry because they want to cry, but by those who are doing their best not to. If you read in a script, she cries or he cries, know that 99 times out of 100, this is the essence of their tears. They try their best not to cry. Those who are doing their best to hold themselves together, even while falling apart, this is what moves us, just as Chekhov said. Even if the writer in the end does have them fall apart. And in that case, that they do so should be up for grabs throughout the story until the very, very last, not to be given away or leaked. Objectivity is the quality which allows us to see ourselves as part of a bigger picture in the universe. When you see your friends talk of their travails as a group, or to as few as one friend, is it not true that most of the time what goes down is not a pointless harangue, but an open expression of how life goes, often delivered with gusto and great humor? Objectivity is a gift we have in order to be able to communicate with one another about ourselves and be heard. Let's do an exercise right now. Take a deep breath and relax for a moment. Okay, now, you've just watched a rather upsetting exchange between a dad and his teenage son, an eruption now come and gone. A reporter comes up to you, an unrelated witness, and asks you, based on what you just saw, how you think the son feels toward his father. You respond with the line, can't stand him. C-A-N apostrophe T, stand apostrophe I-M. Now you are the son himself 2 days later, and you're at your friend's house, and you're asked by him how you feel toward your father, and your line is the same, can't stand him. Said with objectivity, both readings will go remarkably the same, with the only difference being that in the latter case is included the irony that one dislikes one's own provider. And this would likely be the case even if the writing has the character crying while saying it. There is nothing so moving or so funny as objectivity under stress or in calamity. A recent example of this in comedy was seen on television when a young mother in labor pangs has a contraction and screams her head off, only to then look at the doctor and calmly and objectively evaluate the event with the line, "That was a bad one." And that kind of moment in drama as well is gripping and to be found often in good writing. Here is where you'll see the difference between masterwork and less skilled acting. Quite simply, the trap is to act the son's anger, his bitterness and resentment in the reading of the line, rather than allowing the viewer to conclude and experience the existence of those feelings by watching the objective surface of an objective testimonial. The previous exercise is a very good way to always maintain objectivity in your work. It's called the third-person exercise and will work for any material. It is particularly valuable when you think the scene you are playing is a highly personal one, and is the way to get in touch with the objectivity in the material whenever your character speaks of himself. Simply replace the I, us, or we in the script with he, she, them, or their, and you will be amazed at how true and human your work will become, and how effortless it will be. Warning, it won't be unique or theatrical, and may very much be resented by certain artistic authority figures who value emotional performance over emotional effect. But it will be true to life and most intriguing to watch. Have no concern that the audience might not get how deeply you or your character really feels. We know how deeply your character really feels, just as deeply as we feel, no more, no less. And we know what he is feeling because we've been watching the story and we live. What's fascinating and amazing to us is to see the character being so human and objective in spite of what we know he's feeling. After all, what and how he communicates is what is news, not his feelings. We've known his feelings, if we were supposed to, from the very beginning. If his true feelings were hidden, they're required to remain that way. Trust the writing. Let your character remain objective and wonderful things will happen. Are you still saying, yeah, but people aren't like that. They are crummy and they are small and petty and arrogant and negative and everything you're trying to remove from my performance? If, and often it is, if the writer has written the character which has just been described, it would be impossible to remove any of those negative traits which have just been enumerated. They will be made known by the behavior of the character as defined by the plot. In other words, a highly watchable negative personality, be he villain or not, will be known by his deeds, not by his facade. You will know the tree by its fruit, and you can't judge a book by its cover. At least you shouldn't be able to. You'd spoil the surprise. Now, considering this, isn't it logical to make the positive assumption that the most interesting and intelligent thing to find in the material and to play is a character who is cruel, small, cheap, arrogant, petty, yes, but not because he doesn't have any humor or objectivity, but cruel because he has great humor at the expense of others. Cheap, not because he's greedy, but because he believes charity is hypocrisy. Arrogant, not because his nose is up in the air, but because he believes what other people think is idiotic. Petty, not because he thinks small, but because he believes that his are the only dreams to be fulfilled. In life, as in good acting, we are moved not by the feelings of others, but by their trials, and by their nobility in the face of ordeal, and by their true desire not to burden us with what is painful to them. We see so often, for example, on public television, incredibly moving testimonials about the trials of men and women, everything from hearing them tell of being trapped on a life raft for 60 days surrounded by sharks and having those around them succumb, or of men in combat in the battlefield, or a struggle against illness, or survival in the concentration camps, whatever it is. We are moved because we see these people tell their incredible stories with as much objectivity as they can muster. They may momentarily break down, perhaps even sob, but then it's a quick recovery and back to the objective reference once again. You see, we are not moved by their feelings. We are moved by their lives. We are moved by what they had to undergo. We feel for them. And that is the essence of the theatrical experience. In review, technique. When your character speaks of himself, speak as if actively and interestedly relating an experience someone else had, through both joyful and tearful states. This is the end of tape 3 of The Impersonal Actor. We'll continue our discussions on tape 4.